Thank you.
That's it.
Okay, let's get started. Welcome to the sixth, I think, Developmental Disabilities Grand Rounds, sponsored by the Vanderbilt Kennedy Center, the Center for Child Development, and the MIND Training Program. Today it's my honor to introduce Bruce Compass, but before I do that, let me just make a couple of announcements. The pastries are coming. That's probably the one you got.
No pastries?
No pastries yet. They're coming. They are coming. The other thing I wanted to mention was that we are offering CME credits, and you've just received or are receiving the evaluation form. If you could please, everyone, fill out the first question when we're finished, and then those who want CME credits, fill out the rest as well. Okay? Today, Bruce Compass is going to speak to us. Bruce wears many hats. He is the Patricia and Rhodes Hart Professor of Psychology and Human Development. He's a professor in pediatrics. He's the director of the Clinical Psych Training Program, and we just talked about how Bruce saw, 16? Had just interviewed 16 prospective candidates on Monday. And he's also director of the Psychological Oncology Program in the med school. He has been doing work. He received his bachelor's and PhD from UCLA, my old stomping grounds. And for the past several decades, he's been doing work in stress and coping of parents. Several decades in the group?
Years.
A couple of years. A month and a half, 2 weeks. He's been doing work on parents and children with cancer. And on a personal note, I was joking around with Bruce before. I've heard him speak probably 3 or 4 times this year, all in incredibly different contexts. One being no notes, no PowerPoint in front of the Hobbs dinner. Another at a meeting to tell us how the Cancer Center works. Another at Science Day. Very different contexts, and I've never heard him give a bad speech yet. So we are in for a treat, and welcome very much. Hey.
I feel like I should hobble up here after decades of research. Thanks for coming, and it was a long night for a lot of people in Middle Tennessee, so I hope everybody's doing okay, with all respect to what people have been going through. This is a new talk. I haven't given this one before, so it's new jokes, so I'm going to test them out on you. And the main theme here is Jeopardy. So, what is Jeopardy? It is the number one game show of all time. So I hope some of you are, yes, it absolutely is, absolutely. But it's also hazard or risk, exposure to loss, death, harm, injury, sources of peril. And for us today, Jeopardy is going to be that stress is a major source of Jeopardy for us. I teach a class on stress, so I'm acutely aware of the effects of stress, and I want to talk to you about stress as a source of jeopardy, but also as a source of double jeopardy, which is 6 new categories are used, 2 daily doubles in double jeopardy round, and the value of each prize is doubled. But it's also being tried twice for the same offense, which is double jeopardy, and I neglect to have on my slide a great film starring Ashley Judd, which is what double jeopardy is, or it's being adversely affected twice by the same risk factor. And that's how I want to use double jeopardy today, is that stress is a risk factor. Stress puts us at jeopardy. And I want to explain to you why there's double jeopardy involved in stress. So we get affected by it twice. The U.S. Constitution protects us from legal double jeopardy, but it does not protect us from the double jeopardy of stress. So the concept I want to convey to you, the simple one, is stress is bad. Stress is bad for us in a variety of ways, but it's bad for us in hidden ways, in ways that are the focus of our current research. So here are the take-home messages, and there is the ever-present, handsome Alex Trebek. Great guy. Great game show host. We should all emulate him. First, stress and adversity are significant risk factors for physical illness and psychopathology. So you all know that. I'll give you a little bit more news, hopefully some surprises on that. And the Jeopardy process involves the direct effects of stress on psychological and physical health. And there are direct effects. And again, thinking about last night and what many families went through in Middle Tennessee and in Kentucky, a traumatic, stressful experience that will alter many of those people's lives forever. Explain that and how it is that traumatic events affect us for the long haul. But the double jeopardy is that stress has indirect effects on psychological and physical health. And those are the ones that intrigue me the most, and that's where we're focusing a lot of our work. And the difficult news is that stress adversely affects our ability to cope. It has psychological effects on our ability to cope and neurobiological effects on our ability to cope. So the irony that we will see is that the very time when we need our capacity to cope the most, stress impairs our ability to do that. So it's a difficult puzzle. In a sense, it's bad news followed by bad news. So the bad news is the direct effects of stress. The second bad news is the indirect effects of stress. I don't want to leave you there. And so the upturn at the end is that, in fact, we can do something about it. So in spite of the ways that stress constrains and alters our ability to cope, we can teach people better ways to cope. We can turn that process around. And at the neurobiological level, the impressive array of evidence on the neuroplasticity of the brain and development that gives us some hope that things could go in the right direction. Okay. Usually people do acknowledgments at the end. I want to do mine up front because they get hurried at the end. Have the fortune to have great graduate students, 9 current PhD students, and almost 60 total. They're wonderful. I've tried many ways to pick them, and what I've gone with is letters of the last name. So I tried B in the old students. It worked. And I've experimented with D and R. It's worked fabulously. Okay. So it's a complex process. We interviewed all those 16 people. Doesn't matter. Okay, stress. How's your day been so far? Yeah. So those of you who live locally and you're smart, you don't encounter this. But if you come in from Goodlettsville or Williamson County or any of those places, you spend hours every week sitting in traffic. And it delays you and it frustrates you. I'm open and honest in my stress seminar on how bad I am with traffic. It's one of my major stressors. I don't deal with it well. It eats away at me. So that's something that affects us. You might have gotten to your office. And to anybody who works with me, indeed, that's what it looks like. And you walk in and there's this constant reminder, if you pay attention, to all that stuff that's piling up, all that stuff that's not done, and that's stressful, and it accumulates day after day. And then you get the news, you open up your email and get your score on your grant application, and it's a 298 instead of that 103 that you're looking for. So any talk I give on stress, I remind myself and try to remind the audience that the message is, I'll talk to you about research and evidence and studies that we do, but the message is always personal. So you're here this morning. Stress is part of our lives on a chronic daily basis. It gets punctuated by things like what happened last night, but it's a personal thing. So I hope, in addition to a little bit of the science and the research that we do, you'll contemplate things on this level. If your office looks like mine, if you sit in traffic like I do, and if you get the kind of grant scores that I do, then you know what we're talking about. Okay? Okay. Stress comes in a variety of shapes and sizes. So if, again, we use last night as an example, sometimes it's traumatic. So I believe the toll right now is 25 people died last night in Middle Tennessee, 45 in Middle Tennessee and Kentucky. College dorm at Union College near Memphis was torn apart, and students were stuck, trapped in some of those dorm rooms for all night last night. So those traumatic events and what they do to us. For the first time since I've been here in 5.5 years, when those warnings go off and we just ignore them and pay no attention. So we had the news on, I was trying to track the election results, and all you got was the tornado and hurricane results. But for the first time, they named our little neighborhood and said it's bearing down on you. And so took the dog, and Pam and I went down to what we thought was the safest place. And I know exactly what was happening to me physically in the midst of that traumatic event. I knew what my body was doing, I knew what my brain was doing, and I knew the toll it begins to take on you. So those traumatic events count. They're important. One level down from those traumatic events are big life events, things that aren't traumas, but they're major changes, and they're extraordinarily stressful and difficult. So for a child, a parental divorce, moving to a new home, and having to go through all those adjustments. And then stress comes in smaller sizes, recurring minor events or hassles, family conflict, recurrent low levels of pain that some people experience. Each episode, not such a big deal. But when they keep happening again and again and again, we're going to see that's a source of the toll, that recurring nature. and chronic stressful conditions. Any chance I have to say it, I say it. The single greatest source of stress for anyone in the United States is exposure to the chronic stress of poverty. And it affects millions and millions of people in the United States. And there is no greater source of stress and adversity that we should be concerned about. Sometimes I feel shame on myself that I don't spend more of my time invested in that topic and understanding what to do about it. So, different shapes and sizes. And one message is sometimes it's events. It's things that happen. They have an onset and an offset. Other times it's not. It's chronic conditions. You don't know when they start. You don't know when they stop. And they're unrelenting. And if you don't hear any other message today, it's the unrelenting stuff that wears us down, that takes a toll. Tell them I'm busy.
I'm
sorry. That's okay. That's fine. One way to think about traumatic events and other kinds of stress, use this analogy a lot, is a calm pool of water and a pebble hits it. And the traumatic event is the spot where the pebble hits. It's that splash. And that's important. It does have a cost. The most demonstrable cost of those places where the rock hits, that the pebble hits, would be post-traumatic stress disorder. And I think great researchers are untangling how it is that some people, in the face of a trauma, end up re-experiencing it over and over again, experience long-lasting symptoms of anxiety and other difficulties. But the real problem isn't the pebble, it's the ripples. It's how each traumatic event produces long-lasting changes in ourselves and in the environment. So my fear for a lot of the families in Middle Tennessee is, yes, it was a long night, and yes, it was traumatic, but what now? If your house was leveled, if you lost a loved one, the long-term effects of that that just don't go away. So think of these things as interconnected and how they contribute to one another. So I believe that the real story on the direct effects of stress, the single jeopardy part of the story, is that most long-term effects of stress are really the result of chronic stressors, either chronic adverse conditions or recurring chronic stressful events, either one of those two. A good example comes from research of Linda Lucan, who's an associate professor of psychology at Arizona State University. I had the good fortune to have her pass through my lab a number of years ago as a postdoctoral fellow, and I don't think I did much to influence her, just had the great opportunity to see her work, and she is smart. One of her lines of research has been to look at the effects of a traumatic event, parental loss, during childhood on later psychological and biological functioning. And she was smart enough to know she could gather up a sample of college undergraduates and find some of them who sadly had lost a parent as a child. And she asked the simple question, were they different as young adults? And not just were they different psychologically, were they different biologically? And they are. And two ways in which they're different is when exposed to a laboratory stressful task, they show rapid changes, greater changes in a blood pressure response, which is a sympathetic nervous system response to stress, and higher levels of cortisol in response to stress. A lasting, enduring effect of a traumatic event in childhood at a biological level, probably, arguably, driven by psychological processes. But the mediators that she pointed to and that fully explained that relationship was that that loss was accounted for by disruptions in the quality of family relationships and conflict within the home. So that loss produced chronic changes in the family, and it's those chronic changes that led to those lasting biological and psychological effects. The work I'm going to tell you about today, I said this is personal for you all, and as always is for me, but the personal part is layered on top of the research we do, which is about children and adolescents. And kids have stress too. So I'm going to focus on that. A couple of examples of how stress takes a toll. Many different domains for kids. Stress within the home, within the family, peer-related stress, academic stress, events like parental conflict. Marital discord and parental conflict and angry emotions in the home take a major toll on children as they happen again and again and again. Sometimes in unpredictable ways. So it's not only an adverse situation for children, they don't know when it's coming. They can't see it before it happens. Peer rejection, being teased by others. Little events when they happen once or twice, pretty major when they happen again and again and again, week after week. And academic failure and how it takes a toll. There are developmental differences in the direct effects of stress. There's a shift from things being mostly rooted in the family to peer and interpersonal stressors outside the home taking on greater importance in adolescence. So some fairly predictable patterns. And that process of the distant things getting to us through the proximal things shows up in children as well. So in our own work, we have several examples of how a distal stressor, a traumatic or a major event, gets to us under our skin through more proximal or recurrent stressors. So for example, we've studied families in which a parent is diagnosed with cancer and how that affects sons and daughters of those parents who are ill. And it happens through increased stress within the family. So wonderful work that Kathy Grant carried out to show that burdens within the family, caretaking responsibilities, which in fact are assumed by daughters, not sons. There's a stunner for you, huh? That took a toll, and that contributed to heightened levels of anxiety and depression in children whose parents had cancer. And it was in the daughters specifically. We study parental depression and how that takes a toll. And one way it gets there is through difficult and stressful interactions between parents who suffer from depression and their children. So depression manifests itself interpersonally and disrupts parenting and disrupts those relationships in difficult ways and in unpredictable ways that take a toll on children. And poverty, which I said, I think we all ought to pay attention to that. Economic adversity and disrupted parenting are the proximal things. So living in poverty creates chronic situations of economic adversity, but it takes a toll on parents, much like a physical illness, much like a psychological illness. It's a burden for parents, and as parenting gets disrupted, risk for kids goes up. So, proximal stressors, that seems to be the thing that counts, affected by individual differences. So, I don't think there's any surprise there. Stress is bad for you. No, seriously, stress is bad for you. Done with that message. Okay. So now let's think about this double jeopardy part. What should be good for us is that we have the capacity to cope. Okay. We can deal with it. The notion of resilience, that in the face of all that bad stuff, there's something we can do to stem the tide. There's something we can do to get through it. As all those news reports were coming in, and Pam and I came back up from, we don't have a basement, so we're kind of huddled in the back of the garage with the dog, and the dog was thinking, this is really dumb. came upstairs, news is back on, and they were talking with some families. How these newscasters get on the scene within a nanosecond is astonishing to me. But there was a family, and their house wasn't destroyed, but it was badly damaged. And she said, we got the kids, we went into that center hallway, we lay down on the floor, and we prayed. And that's what they were doing, to try to deal with it in that acute situation, trying to cope. And we should be able to do that. But there's this awful, awful message that I'm going to give you, which is when you need it the most, stress makes it hard to cope. So to tell you about that, I have to do a little bit on how we think about coping. So I'm going to give you a little bit of the model that guides our research. So when I tell you how it affects coping, you'll know what kinds of coping we're talking about. If you look at research on how people respond to and cope with stress, there's two rather independent traditions. They're siloed, and we need to break down the silos. One is research on stress reactivity. Focus on, for example, the autonomic nervous system as it reacts to stress and how it recovers from stress. And it's usually done, those studies are usually done in the laboratory under very carefully controlled conditions. See if you can get the autonomic nervous system to respond, find some good indicators of it, galvanic skin response, blood pressure, heart rate, vagal tone, and watch what it does. Great literature. Separate from that is a literature on coping. Looked at as a controlled and strategic process, stuff we do on purpose to try to manage stress, not typically studied in the lab. In fact, 30-something years ago, Richard Lazarus, single most influential researcher on stress and coping, said, you can't study it in the lab, and sent us all out into the real world, and said, you have to ask people. Give them surveys, give them questionnaires, do an interview, but ask them how they cope in their day-to-day life. And so those silos got created, and that's problematic. It's still present if we look at more recent terminology, self-regulation, emotion regulation. Interesting terms, great research, old wine, new bottles. Same stuff. Stress reactivity, coping, emotion regulation, self-regulation. You can connect the dots. It's not too hard to do. So what I think those traditions actually represent, and that we try to capture in a dual process model of how people respond to stress, is one set of processes that are automatic and happen, not on purpose, and another set that are controlled and purposeful and volitional. Both of those things include self-regulation. We automatically self-regulate. In fact, if we didn't, we'd be a mess. So there's a lot of things wired into us to help regulate our emotions, our biology, our cognitions, our behavior. And you never think about it. It just seems to run on its own. But both of these can also be adaptive or maladaptive. So they sometimes work and sometimes don't. Sometimes we have efforts at regulation that are highly effective, and sometimes we have efforts at regulation that are quite disastrous. And we'll see if we can separate those out. And this dual process distinction is everywhere in behavioral science. So neuroscientists talk about dual process models. Cognitive scientists talk about it. Emotion researchers talk about it. This is nothing new, nothing novel here, just taking it and trying to use it to capture stress reactivity and coping. So that first process, those automatic things, they're not under conscious control. Sometimes we know we're doing them and sometimes we don't. So sometimes you do stuff and you have no explanation for why. You just find yourself doing it. Other times, you're doing things you're not aware. You're really not so much on top of what your amygdala is doing. Okay? It's kind of running on its own. It's a good thing that it does, but you're not conscious of it. Best examples are both the sympathetic system, the sympathetic adrenal medullary axis, stress axis, and the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, which is the one I'm going to talk to you about more later on in a few minutes. Okay? They're a result of temperament, conditioning, all kinds of things contribute to it. The second process is coping. And that's the one we care the most about. We define it as conscious and volitional efforts, things we do on purpose, to regulate our emotions, our thoughts, our behavior, our physiology, and even try to regulate the environment around us in response to stressful events and circumstances. We're aware when we do it. It feels like we do it on purpose, and I don't want to get tangled up in that one, whether we really do or don't have the capacity for volitional control. Interesting debate. I'm not going there. But we feel like it. In fact, there's interesting new research on the neurobiology of perceptions of control. And our brains are wired in interesting ways to be tuned into social relationships. They're wired into control. So again, whether we do or we don't, it's fundamental and it's important. And coping is motivated and goal-directed. So if you're a schematic thinker, responses to stress, automatic and controlled processes, which can further be distinguished as involving engagement or disengagement, orienting towards or away. We don't use the term approach avoidance because engagement means either engaging with the stressor or with how I'm responding, engaging with my emotions or engaging with what's happening to me, as opposed to trying to disengage. Disengage from the event, disengage from my emotions. Okay. So that takes that to part one and splits it into two more pieces, each of those parts, automatic and controlled, engagement and disengagement. Symmetrical. Nature is symmetrical. One of the great groups of grad students I had in Vermont before I came here, and the group that I worked with on trying to think all this stuff through, I just kept pounding my shoe on the table. I said, nature is symmetrical. This model will be symmetrical. And Jennifer Connor Smith said, no, it won't. And she was right. So I lost the argument. So it's symmetrical up to this point. And then on the coping side, we have another branch that isn't symmetrical. And we tried to make it that way. We tried to force it. We did study after study trying to make a model fit that was symmetrical. And Jennifer was right. It's not. And it's that engagement coping responses break down further in a way organized by control, primary control and secondary control. So full model gets a little messier. Engagement and disengagement is that overriding concept in coping. Primary control coping are things that I do to directly try to solve the problem and address the stressor or directly try to alter my emotions. Problem solving fits there. Efforts to modulate my emotions, calm myself down directly, or express my emotions by talking to someone or, importantly, writing about it. Very powerful, modulated, controlled way to express my emotions. Good stuff for stressors you experience as controllable. If you experience them as uncontrollable, good thing to do, it turns out, is secondary control coping, which is efforts to adapt to things the way they are. John Weiss, wonderful clinical psychologist, University of North Carolina, then at UCLA and now at Judge Baker Children's Center and Harvard, guided us on the importance of secondary control and cultural differences in the importance of secondary control. It includes rethinking the problem, cognitive reappraisal or restructuring, accepting a problem, not resigning myself to it, but accepting it, distracting myself from it, which is not disengaging, it turns out, and trying to think more positively. And on the far side over there, disengagement, psychologists never give you a hard and fast rule. We're chicken about that. We always qualify. We always hedge. We always say maybe. We always say, oh, we need more evidence. All right, here's one. Disengagement coping sucks. It just doesn't work. Okay? Take it home. Believe me. All right? And it doesn't work for a variety of reasons. One of the major reasons is that it disrupts the other stuff. If you're avoiding, if you're wishing it away, if you're denying the problem, it's pretty hard to engage in acceptance, to reframe it, to solve the problem. So it gets in the way of the other stuff. And it ironically rebounds. Try not to think about something. Avoid that thought. And the harder you try, the more you think about it. Okay. So if you know Dan Wegner's work, he studies white bears, but there's bigger things at stake, unless you're an Inuit, than white bears. Yes?
Sorry, why is distraction not
Because it actually involves reorienting your attention to something else. So it's shifting attention away from A onto B, whereas cognitive avoidance is don't think about A. And Wegner's studies show that the best. I can say, in trying to get this model to fit, and when I was arguing for symmetry, we tried to jam it in that box over there, and in study after study, in confirmatory factor analysis, one after another, it will not hang around with avoidance, denial, and wishful thinking. It's good friends with acceptance and cognitive reappraisal and thinking positively. So it's the difference between, I'm not going to think about that, versus I'm going to think about something else. And a lot of us try not to think about something without giving ourselves an alternative target to deploy our attention. Intention's tricky in that way, tough thing to control. One of the difficulties in coping research is that it's often based on single methods, use questionnaires, and I've been worried about that for a long time, that it's driven by those single methods. With the help of David Cole here, we were able to do a latent variable model in which we use parent and child report, two very different methods, to see if we could converge on the model, and it did, quite elegantly. So just for those of you who are methodological nitpickers, it's not all based on questionnaires, it's not all based on self-reports, it holds up robustly. In a study we did with children suffering from recurrent and chronic abdominal pain, not only did it converge, the model played out quite nicely in predicting symptoms in the way we thought, and that is that more secondary control coping, adapting to and accepting this recurrent pain is something really that I can't control, was a good response. Trying to disengage, trying to wish it away, trying to deny it, trying to avoid it, had this paradoxical rebound and made things worse. And again, not just based on single informant self-reports. Okay. So we're doing this research, and we're moving along, and we think we're understanding coping, and then we get this finding that's nagging. It's bothersome. It's irritating. And you want, you know what you do with those, you want to just like sweep them under the rug. You have that ethical thing, should I put that damn thing in the paper? But I'm just moral to the core, and I have to put it in the paper, and we have to explain it. So here's the problem. When we looked in our studies with adolescents, when they report stress, their reports of stress are associated with how they say they cope. Kind of makes sense. But the problem is, stress is positively associated with adaptive coping and negatively with maladaptive. The more stress, it's working backwards. So the ironic thing is, as stress increases, I actually think I wrote that line backwards, it's that as stress increases, I do more of the maladaptive stuff and less of the adaptive stuff. So the irony is, as stress goes up, I do bad things, not good things. And we had to say, just an artifact, just questionnaires, just some kind of mindset. But it held up. And it held up when we used parent reports to try to look at adolescent reports. We couldn't shake it. So here's one example of how it came up. This was in a study of 350 rural, low-income adolescents struggling with low SES and the strains that come from that economically and family conflict that arises from it. So a somewhat complicated path model. The main thing I want to highlight is as family conflict went up, the kids used less primary control coping, less secondary control coping, and they disengaged more. So as the stakes got higher and more stress was there and more was on the line and things got tougher, they bailed. They didn't do the good stuff. They did more of the bad stuff.
Is this a prospective? You say as it got tougher, yeah. This is a prospective.
We have it in prospective data. This particular one is just cross-sectional, so those kids with more stress report doing, but prospectively it holds up as well. So again, holds up across methods. So we had to say maybe there's something going on here more than just an artifact. So we started to look. And one place to look is for research on cognitive load and stress. And as cognitive load increases, as we have more and more things to kind of multitask, more things to juggle, lectures to prepare, talks to give, grants to review, students' papers to read, hiding in the basement. As stress accumulates, one thing after another, those greater demands exert a cognitive load. And as cognitive load increases, it disrupts higher-order cognitive processes. So think for a moment about what it means to cognitively reappraise, to accept, to use positive thinking, to generate problem-solving skills, to modulate your emotions. Turns out it's rather cognitively complex. So it's possible that coping is a higher-order cognitive process. I think so. And it's based in executive functions, and those executive functions get disrupted as stress goes up. So for one study, we said, let's take a look. Let's see if we can show if coping is an executive function, and I think we have a pretty good answer to that. We looked at association between performance on neuropsych measures of executive function and how kids cope. In this study, we oversampled for disruptive behavior disorders, for kids who showed problems with regulatory control, so we got a good spread on that type of problem. We did three executive function tasks, a stop task or a go-no-go task, where you're learning on a trial to respond to something, and then the instruction is not to respond to that. So you really have to put the brakes on and inhibit. Stroop inhibition task, a color word naming task. You've got to override and inhibit the prepotent response. And a delay of gratification task. And there were two questions. Are those related to more disruptive behavior problems? Yes, they are. Are they related to coping? Turns out they are. And does that explain how executive function ties to those problems? So primary control coping was related to all three. Kids with better executive function reported using more primary control coping, and their parents also reported that they did. Secondary control coping was related to the Stroop and the go-no-go task. And disengagement coping, better executive function, less disengagement. So it fit the model that as I increase with my executive self-control skills and have those higher-order cognitive complex processes, I seem to cope better. And that it mediated the relationship, coping did, between executive function and externalizing problems. So that those are standardized beta, and that beta dropped significantly when we took coping into account. So this gave us some confidence that we're on a right track here, that in fact, coping is executive function put into action. We use our executive functions a lot in a lot of different situations, not just under stress, but we have to draw on them. They're the platform on which our coping responses are built when we need them. So that seemed interesting, but then we wanted to push it a little further. And for me, one of the great benefits of coming here, in addition to being exposed to tornadoes instead of blizzards when I moved from Vermont, you know, blizzards are tough, but they're just never going to rip the top off your house. So this is harder. Begin to look at the neurobiology of coping and the neurobiology of executive functions. This is a great place to be able to do that, just the resources and colleagues available to us and the support we've been able to get to do this work, including great support from the Kennedy Center. So coping related to executive function. Executive functions are based in the prefrontal cortex. Dorsolateral prefrontal cortex is becoming my favorite brain part. We're interested in working memories. So just as an aside, one important type of coping, secondary control coping, is cognitive reappraisal, to be able to look at a situation and think about it differently. Look at the glass as half full rather than half empty. Emphasize the positive. Look for something hopeful or for some benefit that might come out of something bad. To do that, I have to keep the problem in mind and I have to act on it. That is, by definition, a working memory task. Hold something actively in memory and do something to it. So part of the task then is, can we make a connection between the two? Do we know where working memory is based in the brain? And we do. And begin to look at how things might affect those processes. Are there things that could adversely affect it? So are there ways in which we can begin to tie these together? The construct of allostatic load, chronic stress, seems like a good candidate to understand threats to the brain regions that are responsible for executive function and for coping. And it's possible that chronic stress may neurobiologically impair the ability to cope. In case your attention fades in and out and you think about that pile of stuff on your desk and you don't get the next 10 minutes, in fact, that's exactly what's going on. Biologically, stress alters, sculpts, reshapes, in bad ways, the brain regions responsible for complex coping. So, effects of chronic stress on the brain, in fact, are not random. One very pronounced effect, well established in a lot of studies, is the effects on the hippocampus. Hippocampus is critical for memory. I'm just not getting comfortable with my hippocampus. I'm trying to get it tied into coping. I'm trying to figure out why it's so important, and we're just not on good terms. So it seemed important, but it was not satisfying to say, oh, well, stress affects the hippocampus, that's it then, it's going to have an effect on coping. What I wanted to know is, does it affect the prefrontal cortex? And thank heavens for, I have a slide that I use sometimes in talks, I pitched it on this one, which the title of the slide is Bruce is the Boss. And on that slide, there's a picture of the boss, Bruce Springsteen. There's a picture from Live Free, Die Hard, okay, Bruce Willis, the boss. And then the other real powerful Bruce, who's Bruce McEwen. He's the godfather of stress. He's an absolute genius. And it is his work and work that comes from his lab. Not the boss, honest. Not, you can ask anybody in my lab. They chuckle when it comes up with me, the idea of me as the boss. Not the boss, but those guys are the boss. In McEwen's lab and in others, there are now at least 5 studies that I've identified that show direct pronounced effects of recurrent and chronic stress on the prefrontal cortex, neurobiological effects of stress on the PFC. So it comes mostly from studies, non-human animal studies, studies with rats. The prototype of the stressor is restraint stress. So the rat is placed in a clear plastic tube and not allowed to move for extended periods of time. It would be like being in an fMRI for like 4 hours or something, but even more constrained. And if you're a rat, not so good. Okay, that's pretty chronically stressful when it happens day after day. The effects in the prefrontal cortex include reduced dendritic density, okay, cell death, kills cells in the prefrontal region, reduced length of pyramidal neurons, so they shrinkage, impaired synaptic plasticity, difficulty in responding to change, and impaired long-term potentiation. And a behavioral indicator in one of the studies was they put the rats through a classic working memory task for a rat. It's different than what we do, but you can test it, and working memory was impaired at the behavioral level. So there's the link. And that was the one that began to tie things together for us. It wasn't just that damn hippocampus that I can't figure out what to do with. And if anybody can, tell me. I'd just love to get on better terms, speaking terms with it. But the projects of the prefrontal cortex. Okay, well, there you go. it's like saying it's the laptop and the projector. Okay, I get it. All right, so there's a problem with the laptop or the projector is one or the other. Got it. Okay. That's good. I'm glad he's here. We can always fill in the gaps when we need them. So, but be that as it may, that there are effects, pronounced effects, in a growing literature. Most of these studies are within the last year or two beginning to target this. Now, the underlying biology of how it gets affected, we'll talk a little bit about, and I'm puzzled on that one, but there's good evidence. So what's the culprit? Looks like the culprit is the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis because the molecular culprit is cortisol. So the HPA axis is activated probably by other sources in the amygdala and the locus coeruleus, but talking to the hypothalamus, which then talks to your pituitary gland and downstream affects the adrenals. And I like this figure because it reminds me that it's not all happening in the brain. There's a long cascade. And all the evidence says cortisol takes a little while to show up. And one reason it takes a while to show up is look at the cascade. There's a series of 2 intermediate hormones, messenger hormones, and it's got to get down to the adrenals, which sit on top of your kidneys. So if you've scrunched all that up, in fact, if your adrenal gland was in your neck, which would be a problem because your kidney would be in your neck, and that's not a good thing, it would look like this, which is the hypothalamus produces corticotropin-releasing hormone, triggering the pituitary to release ACTH, which then talks to the cortex of the adrenal gland. So the cortex is producing cortisol. The medulla of the adrenal gland is producing catecholamine. So it's the effects on the cortex to then release cortisol into the system. Does a lot of things, some of which are very beneficial. I now understand that it dumps sugar into the bloodstream. It accesses from the liver a short-term storage of carbohydrates and sugars and gets those out there for action within about 30 minutes after a stressor. So been through a big stressor. Don't eat a piece of cake 30 minutes later because you've got plenty of sugar in your blood system. You're doing okay. So don't get that ice cream 30 minutes after something bad. In fact, don't take your kids out after a stressor and give them an ice cream 30 minutes after it happened. How does it get back into the brain? If cortisol is important and it's implicated, I said, and we were covering this yesterday in our seminar, a 3-hour seminar. We spent 3 hours on the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, which is more than anybody should. And I said, really, it's a case of a good hormone gone bad. And so how does it go bad? And it goes bad under chronic stress because there's a feedback loop. It goes back to the brain. And one place there are receptors is in the hypothalamus to put the brakes on the system. Good thing. But the receptors are also in the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex, and they go back, and those receptors pick up cortisol as it's circulating in the bloodstream. Cortisol binds to two kinds of receptors in the brain, glucocorticoid receptors and mineralocorticoid receptors, which are distributed unevenly in different brain regions. When it binds to those, it actually alters the DNA within the cell, which is pretty powerful. So the effects can be not short-term, but quite long-term. So what are we doing to study this? Now, with McEwen's model out there and the idea that stress could have potential adverse effects, and especially chronic stress on the brain, we're looking at two ways it might happen. One I want to call an exogenous process that mimics chronic stress, and the other is an endogenous process directly involving chronic stress. The exogenous process is one we have encountered in children with cancer, where the source of threat to brain function and development comes from outside of them, comes as part of their treatment. The group we're studying to model chronic stress are children of depressed parents. And if you can imagine a parent who suffers recurrently from major depressive disorder, and even when they're not in an episode, they're struggling with mood-related difficulties, they're struggling with their ability to parent, and there's a lot of stress in those homes, those kids are chronically stressed. So let's talk about the exogenous one first. Kids with acute lymphocytic leukemia survive now, much better than they did 15 or 20 years ago. In fact, that rate has gone from about 50 to approximately 75 to 80% of children will survive their illness. The main jump that's been made is not so much with more effective treatment of leukemia cells, but with preventing metastases of the cancer in other parts of the body, in particular in the brain. And the way that's done is to dose the brain and the cerebral spinal fluid with high doses of two things. One, high-dose chemotherapy, typically methotrexate, and high doses of a synthetic glucocorticoid, dexamethasone. So if you've been hanging with me, you already connected the dots. So you dump that into the brain, what's going to happen to brain development? Well, methotrexate may have effects its own, but dexamethasone may be in there doing some of these things that McEwen has pointed out that cortisol is going to do. So, are there long-term adverse side effects? Yes, there are. So we conducted a meta-analysis led by Laura Campbell, a graduate student in our lab who's now a postdoc at the University of Virginia. A great study, pulled together the literature and documented across 28 studies demonstrable neurocognitive effects in survivors of childhood ALL. And the one I've highlighted is executive function, approaching a medium effect size, that's a Hedges G, and that's a significant effect. So that led us then, with that as background, to Laura's dissertation, which is our first foray into doing a neurocognitive study with these children. We were able to recruit 30 children who had completed treatment for standard risk ALL, and 30 as matched as we could, healthy controls, matched on age, gender, and when possible on family socioeconomic status. An interesting aside, we tried to use the sort of snowball way to recruit the peers, so ask the patients and their parents, can you name 5 classmates of the same gender as your child who we could contact, and about 90% of the parents said, no thanks, don't want to do that. Don't really want to go into the classroom and talk about my child's cancer and see if we can get people to participate. So we had to go more circuitous routes and do our best to try to identify a group that we could match on age and gender. The results replicated what we saw in the meta-analysis. So significant effects on working memory, one type of executive function, in the ALL survivors. So on the WISC working memory index, difference of about 6/10 of a standard deviation on the brief, which is a measure completed by the parents about their children's working memory, significant difference of about 1/2 a standard deviation. The brief is scored in the opposite direction of what you would think. A higher score is more problems, so both of these pointed in the same direction. Scores on those measures, on the working memory index and on the brief, were correlated with coping in the ways we would expect. Higher executive function scores, higher working memory, more primary and secondary control coping, lower scores, more disengagement. Okay. And then, like what we did in that previous study with those kids with externalizing problems, we modeled executive function, in this case predicting internalizing symptoms. There was a significant relationship, and it was mediated by the coping stuff. So, again, seeing in these kids evidence for coping as executive function put into action. So then the next question is, well, what does the dexamethasone and the methotrexate do to the brain? And that means moving into doing the imaging studies that we're involved in now. So kind of almost the home stretch here is to tell you about what we're seeing inside the brain. So pairing up with Adam Anderson in our first study, supported by the National Cancer Institute, we wanted to look at potential effects on glial cells leading to failure to or demyelination of the prefrontal region. So interesting thing about the last brain region to be myelinated, and it continues myelination into young adulthood, is the prefrontal region, making it vulnerable to things that might alter those myelination processes, and that's taken care of by the glial cells. Well, they're fast-acting, fast-growing cells, and chemotherapy may very well target those. So we're using imaging techniques to try to see what we can find on that, and one working memory task we use in a functional imaging task is an NBAC test. If you've never done an NBAC test, you're lucky. It's horrible, it's boring. They made me go in the scanner. Dr. Van Slyke and others said, if you're going to put children in there, you're going in first, and I went in. I said, that's going to pull the fillings out of my teeth. I'm claustrophobic. Don't make me do it. But they just forced me in there. And doing the NBAC was the worst part of it. It was horrible. So on a zero back, we're just going to tell you the letters aren't going to be highlighted in any different color. The letters are just flashing. We say, hit the button every time you see an N. And a one back, every time you see an N followed by an N. And then it starts to get harder. An N, another letter, and an N. So you start to put ones in between, and a two-back, an N, two other letters, and then an N. So up there you can see examples of one-backs and two-backs and three-backs. So they move up in increasing levels of difficulty. As they move in increasing levels of difficulty, greater demand on the prefrontal cortex, more challenging, higher-order cognitive kinds of processes represented. So led by Kristen Robinson in our lab and working with Adam Anderson, we now have, these are the data from 8 ALL survivors and 7 controls, I believe. This is the comparison of performance group aggregated data on the zero back task, hit it every time you see an N, and a two back task where there's going to be these other letters coming in between. The overall performance was noteworthy. The children didn't differ. The ALL kids performed as well as the healthy controls. However, they had to work a hell of a lot harder. So we see the brain activity in Brodmann Area 9, dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, response to increasing difficulty on an NBAC task, and there's a significant difference in activation required by these ALL survivors. Now, I went in thinking the opposite. If there's damage, it won't work as well. And what we see is really a compensatory effort because of inefficiency in that region. So the best analogy I can think of is I have a student in my lab, wonderful senior honor student, who's on the cross-country team here at Vanderbilt. And if he and I, Austin and I, went for a run, and we ran 2 miles, and we finished at the same speed, I'm telling you who was working harder. Okay? It was me. So he's cruising, and he's looking like the brain on the right, and I'm working my tail off looking like the one on the left. So greater recruitment, so we're seeing here levels of oxygenated blood flow to those regions, greater recruitment and greater effort in order to achieve the same effect. So we think we're on to something using that task. So now, supported by a Hobbs Discovery Grant from the Kennedy Center, we're going to...
Bruce, you see the same thing in schizophrenia.
Yeah, and yes, and one place where we began to get comfortable with that effect was studies done with MS patients and showing the same thing there, where you'll see the same performance, but this incredible compensatory effort of how we have to work so much harder because it's so much less efficient. So our model with the cancer children is the chemotherapy potentially affecting white matter, then leading to these executive function deficits. We know they're having difficulty in school. We're now trying to map it onto impaired ability to cope. The other piece of the puzzle, though, is that dexamethasone. And it could be that the methotrexate targets those fast-growing and active glial cells and destroys them. But in addition, now that we understand binding in the prefrontal cortex for both natural and potentially synthetic glucocorticoids, the dexamethasone could be taking another hit and altering actually gray matter development. So what we're doing in this current grant is pressing on and going back to that exogenous effect from the synthetic glucocorticoids, studying survivors again of pediatric ALL, but now bringing in a group of the endogenously stressed group, where the glucocorticoids are being produced by chronic stress within the environment and bathing the prefrontal cortex chronically with high doses of natural glucocorticoids, which would be cortisol, and then a group of healthy controls. We'll do a working memory task again. We're becoming quite attached to the NBAC, and we'll probably go ahead and use it. It looks like it has good discriminatory power in that first study. And then we'll do a reappraisal task in the scanner, give them an emotional task, and work on how to reappraise it. We tried that in the first study after great debate. This is where Jen Connor-Smith won the argument earlier on, and I should have given in on this one because I said, no, here's what we're going to do. We're going to show these kids clips from Jaws, and it'll arouse an emotion, and then we'll have them reappraise it, and then we'll show them another clip from Jaws. And the RAs are all saying, you're stupid. It's not scary. It won't bother them. Well, The two of the first four kids, one of them, we explained, we're going to show you this film, it might have some emotions, and honest to God, the kid says, well, as long as it's not Jaws, then I'll be okay. And we do a couple more kids, and then one says, well, as long as it's not about sharks, because I'm really afraid of sharks. But I'm not sure it's the right one, because it's not personally relevant. So we're working on stressors that have a little more personal relevance than getting eaten by a shark, and seeing if in Scanner, following work of James Gross and others at Stanford, you do some instruction on reappraisal, and we would expect to see the same inefficiency. The kids are going to have to work a lot harder in our two damaged groups, our exogenous and exogenous groups, to affect that reappraisal process. So that's the hypothesis. We will, in both studies, the current one and the future one, use diffusion tensor imaging, guided by Adam on that, to look at levels of myelination to see if the disruption occurs at that level. So, there's a bad story in there, which is, looks like, from McEwen's work, looks like from some parallels we're seeing in the cancer survivors, that stress has this pernicious effect on important brain regions responsible for coping. I don't want to leave you in a bad way. So let me leave you on a more upbeat note. And the main upbeat note I can give you is, this is the first time I'm going to share some data from another trial we're doing with offspring of depressed parents and their families. You can change coping. And when you change it, there's beneficial effects. So we've been pounding away on this for 4 years. We've been squeezing the data, trying to make it go away, say it's not a real effect. We've done all our intention to treat analyses, controlled for drop, and I think we actually have a real effect. So what the real effect is this. So is the situation hopeless? Absolutely not. We can teach people how to cope. We can turn this thing around. So parents with depression and their families, cognitive behavioral intervention, working with families, four families at a time, we teach two things. We teach the parents better parenting skills, and we teach coping skills to the kids. The skills we teach to the kids are secondary control coping skills. And the reason is we begin with a first message. It's not your fault. Mom or dad is depressed, and it's not your fault. And it is startling how many kids are holding themselves responsible for the sadness and the anguish of their parents. The second message we give them, and this is a tough one, we have to give this message to mom and dad too, is you can't fix it. You can love them, you can care about them, but you can't fix them. That's not what kids do. What you can do is learn how to cope with it differently, where while we're trying to help mom and dad, be there a little bit better for you. So we're trying to reduce the stress in the family by working on the parenting. At the same time, we teach the coping skills to the kids. We've now randomized over 150 families in the study here and at the University of Vermont, which is where I began the work. And we teach this ADAPT set of skills, acceptance, distraction, positive thinking, which is really cognitive reappraisal. We teach it to kids ages 9 to 15, and they get it. Believe it or not, you can teach acceptance to 9 and 10-year-old kids. They understand it. We have a group right now, which is mostly teenage girls from these families, but there happened to be a 9-year-old boy, and we were worried. We thought he's not going to get it, and he's going to lag behind the girls. They did the acceptance session, and the therapist said, wow, it was amazing. He understood what we were talking about, that you just have to say, this is the way it is, and it's okay. I'm not resigned to it, but I can't change it. It is the way it is. So what we have right now are significant changes in the randomized design compared to our control condition, significant increases in the use of secondary control coping in these kids, significant decreases in symptoms of anxiety and depression in these kids. This is all at 6 months. And significant decreases in parents' depressive symptoms. And it's a whopping effect. So a significant decline in depression in the parents by engaging them in what I think is really behavioral activation and a sense of hope that we can help them do things different. And P of 0.09 right now at the six-month follow-up, where we didn't expect a lot of episodes of depression, but in the kids, already a trend where there's three times as many episodes of depression in the controls as in the kids in the treated group. So it gives me hopeful sense that you can teach things, you can teach skills in the face of chronic stress, and if there is an underlying neurobiological effect, there's a hopeful message about neuroplasticity. The brain can change, not just in bad ways, but the brain can turn around and rebound. If you create the right opportunities for it, particularly creating opportunities where there is an experience of control. Steve Mayer and his colleagues in Colorado have shown that there is an inoculative effect of control-related experiences to being able to manage and deal with stress that actually has effects underlying neurobiology in the brain. So the hopeful message is I think we can turn it around, and we'll keep you posted on how this turns out. Thanks. We have like maybe 3 minutes. I don't know if there's time for questions or if there are any. It was too simple.
In the NMAC imaging, did you also measure response times?
Yes, and so we did error rates, and I can't remember the response time offhand, but yeah. So you're thinking maybe
it would be comparable also to the accuracy. There was no difference.
There was no difference. My hunch is because it comes at this pretty rapid rate that it probably was no difference in response time, but it would be interesting to look at that, see again if there's inefficiency or not. Yeah.
So when you're looking at the survivors with ALL,
Not yet, and we would like to. So the first study we did was funded internally by a grant from the Cancer Center Core Grant here, small sample. We have a pilot sample funded here. So our sample sizes at this point are around 10 or 12 patients in each study. What we're doing is gearing up for a much larger study at some point. Have to be a multi-site study, and that's a very important question, is how old were they when they were treated? So we can begin to look at different windows of when is the brain more vulnerable versus not. But what I'm convinced about in terms of the prefrontal development is, oh my God, adolescence, it's a vulnerable period all the way into young adulthood, and it has helped me understand my children in profoundly different ways.
I'm sorry, can I just ask one more?
So basic question, how does coping develop? When do different things develop? There's a wonderful annual review of psychology paper by Ellen Skinner. I think something in the title is Development of Coping. Didn't describe any age differences. And I recently got another paper to review on the development of coping. And I'm quite negative in my review because we just don't know. So I really don't think from the perspective of coping and even from emotion regulation, we have a good roadmap on when these things emerge. My guess is we're looking at early adolescence as a critical period, but I just don't know. And I think these skills continue to develop in pretty profound ways all the way through adolescence. But the developmental roadmap on that is wide open. Somebody ought to do it. So with the second one, I think the question is separating cold versus hot tasks. And so that's why we've continued to persist with the NBAC. We have a Simon task, which is a variant of the Stroop that we did in the cancer sample study, and then the hot tasks, which are the emotional ones. And I think if we can identify tasks that are relatively less emotional, it turns out the NBAC is emotional because it frustrates the hell out of you. But if we dampen down those, I think that's a step in the right direction. And I do see it as foundational. So I think if those skills are not there, it's going to be pretty hard to bring them online when I need them under heightened affective arousal. If they are there, I think, though, there can be a disconnect. I have the fundamental skills, but I can't move them in when I'm emotionally aroused. So I think there's some ability to separate. We certainly haven't done it yet, and I'm not sure I've seen studies that have. Now, my working memory capacity is shot to hell because I'm stressed all the time, and I can't remember your first question.
Although the first question was whether there's an altered ability to recognize that. Emotion.
Yes.
Emotional balance in individual survivor.
Good. So we haven't looked at it in this sample, and it is that emotional recognition thing, emotion processing. People are looking at that in the offspring of depressed parent research and children with a history of depression showing impaired ability in terms of emotion recognition. And I think what's interesting there is that whole, the work of Richie Davidson and others looking at left and right symmetry and asymmetry and activation in those prefrontal regions. And when I'm struggling with those emotion recognition and emotion regulation skills, left and right look real different. And so we want to look at that as well. So, Ken?
Fabulous talk. First.
Thanks.
And just a little speculation on your part about the developmental issue. I work with adults, coping in adults, different kinds of conditions, and I find very much the same kinds of things that you find, not as quite as elegantly. So what are your thoughts about, you know, does this ever stop? I have a feeling that it continues on into adulthood and the same things are going on. It's not just adolescence or
No, it's not. So I have pretty much stopped work I've done with adult cancer patients, but spent a lot of time doing that. And my first exposure to neurocognitive effects in cancer patients was with women with breast cancer. So I've continued to try to track that literature, demonstrable neurocognitive effects in breast cancer survivors, called chemo brain in adults, and whether that gets applied to these kids or not, we'll see. Where I've gone with that is, yes, those things are showing up. It mimics things that we see in aging. So when we begin to see neurodegeneration as part of aging, these are some of the regions that are affected. And one of the most exciting things that we're kicking around now is there's real good evidence that an intervention that's beneficial for stemming some of that decline is aerobic exercise. Yeah, and so they're doing aerobic exercise studies with patients with Alzheimer's disease. They're doing it with adults with breast cancer. It's a great fit for kids, so we're exploring it. And so this is embarrassing. So I don't read a lot. I read all this stuff, and my wife's in like 5 book clubs, and she tried to get me in a co-ed book club, and I don't know, did I never read the book? And so I'm in an airport coming back, and I think, all right, I'm going to put the journals away. I'm going to go over there. I'm going to find a magazine. So what do I leap in? I buy Scientific American. Is that embarrassing? But in it is an article on Lou Gehrig's disease and better understanding what's happening in Lou Gehrig's disease and its shrinkage of these motor neurons and what are the current ways of trying to deal with it. It's insulin-like growth factor and growth hormone to try to stem the time. And they're showing that it works. And you see neuroregeneration, you see a slowing of the degeneration process. Now that's motor neurons, but it's possible that those things could have effect on the brain. And what aerobic exercise does is stimulates those hormones. And they've shown dosing people with growth hormone versus randomly assigning them to aerobic exercise, you get equal effects. Put the two together and you double the effect. So exercise demands growth from cells, including nerve cells, and apparently could even be within the brain. Now, whether it's in the regions we want or not, you might have to play video games while you're on the treadmill in order to get it to happen, but it could be that there's regenerative processes that could come.
There's actually work by Judy Cameron with Bill Greenow where they've got monkeys running on treadmills.
There you go. There you
increase,
go.
There's increased vascularization of areas like interstitial cortex.
Good.
It's remarkable. And they're happier monkeys. They have secondary skills. They tend not to avoid bananas.
That's right. They cope elegantly. I can just imagine. And they are good at expressing their emotions. I can just see it. So, all right. Any other questions? We're running over time. All right. Well, thank you. And thanks to the Kennedy Center.